It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Have you ever tried to lobby a U.S. senator? How about when you were a teenager?
We walk into the Senate building. Me, a UN staffer, and a gaggle of girls.
This is Angie Jiang. She's 17.
We ask our, chaperone, who are we seeing first? Oh, we're just seeing Tammy Baldwin's staffers. And we're like, oh, darn, didn't get to see her. That sucks. We walk into the room. We're giving this pitch. All these girls are just expressing their passions, gender equality, and the right to education, the right to having a future. The door clicks a little bit. It opens. I look to my right, and it's Tammy Baldwin. She's like, hi, girls. And I was like, oh. Fangirl moment. She sits down, and she's listening, and I knew what I was talking about. All the girls knew what they were talking about. And she did go on to co-sponsor and associate her name with the bill that we were talking about. The meeting's over. We leave. We take a picture. It's great. You open the door, and there's, a group of activists chanting about healthcare, waving signs, and they're protesting the potential repeal of the Affordable Care Act. This whirlwind of advocacy. We had just gotten out of a meeting, and obviously not all teens have the opportunity to go to D.C. and talk to representatives and senators, but it is changing. We are being listened to, especially now.
High school walkouts, marches, national protests. This is an incredible moment. And I don't know about you, but I've been watching these kids with so much pride. Because this generation is not asking us, the adults, for permission. They have superpowers. Innocence, idealism, and Instagram. Today, let's meet some of them, beginning with Angie Jiang. She's a high school senior. She's on the swim team. She loves Beyonce. Oh, and she's an advisor to the UN Foundation's Girl Up.
I think Gen Z is very progress-oriented, and it's very pervasive throughout the generation. Teen activists have existed for centuries, but this generation in particular, I can't think of a single person in my life who's my age that isn't passionate about social justice or, progress. At least that's my experience. I can't speak for all teenagers, obviously, but I think the idea of Gen Z is morphing from this technology-driven age to this activist generation. When I see the speeches of Emma Gonzalez or other activists from Parkland, I see my friends.
I think for a lot of us, the sophistication and the strength of your voices, it's astonishing to us that you can have that at age 17. I mean, how?
Yeah, I think out of necessity, we are so exposed as a generation to the world's ills and the world's negative things that it's only natural for us to come out of this age saying, we want to change that. I don't think we've had some teenager boot camp to all get politically active, but I think the sentiment is really there.
Are you angry?
I am frustrated. I think anyone in our situation would be frustrated. It almost feels like we were served this dish of gun violence and climate change and systemic racism that you just can't avoid because you're born into this. And that's frustrating. It's also frustrating that I could go on a rant, but it's frustrating that despite this being handed to us, we can't say anything about it.
But because you're teenagers and not considered to have a legitimate voice yet?
Exactly. The example that we always use is climate change, right? We're in this insurmountable amount of carbon emissions and the temperatures are rising and the sea levels are rising. And that's scary. But if we just become paralyzed in fear, nothing will get done, right? And I think if not today, then when? So we have to do it now. That sounds really cheesy, but...
No, it sounds really inspiring. Can you tell me about Girl Up? When you and the others get together, what do you talk about?
Oh my gosh, it's magical. Every time that we get together, it's like a Mountain Dew Kickstart. That's sponsored. It's like an energy drink. It's like a family of 20 just super driven, super passionate girls who are working on all these amazing projects. Like my friend Shanice, she's 15. She just released her first book called Young Revolutionary, and she interviews activists from around the country. I'm in it. It's like a handbook for teenage activists, and it's amazing. We have conversations about systemic racism or gender-based violence and like all these big concepts. But at the end of the day, we're just a bunch of high school girls getting together, loving each other and empowering each other.
You know, so often adults focus on what teens need to learn. I guess this hour, I really wanted to turn it around and ask, what can adults learn from your generation, from teens?
I think, I don't know if there's a lot other than like, listen to us. Okay, we're young. I get it. We don't have as much experience as you. We're not as cynical as you are, but we have ideas and we have things we want to change. And don't be afraid of change. Gen Z is just ever changing, so we don't have time to be afraid of it. But if you see a wave or a system changing, don't be afraid all the time and have courage. Don't be afraid of change. Please listen to us and have passion. Like, live every... This is so cheesy. I don't want to be like, I'm a teen. Listen to me say these cheesy things. But
maybe you should say it, because maybe adults are too scared to say the stuff that's true.
Right. I think every day and every minute and every hour, you are investing your time into something. And if you're not investing it into something you're passionate about or something that you want to change, then it's time wasted, right? Take chances.
That's Angie Jiang. She's a senior at West High School in Madison, Wisconsin, and a national teen advisor to the UN Foundation's Girl Up. It's funny, when you raise a child, one year you're wiping away their tears and putting Band-Aids on their knees, and the next they're ready to take on the world. It's kind of like magic.
I was scared. I feel like in elementary school, I grew up being kind of like scared. And I spent like a lot of my time in the library. The library was really a place for me to shield myself, because I was in my little shell and I was always trying to protect who I was and my feelings. Seeing all those books. People are equal, you know, they were able to check the same amount of books as the other person. They don't see where you come from and your skin color. So I feel that the library was a time where I didn't feel nervous. The time just for me to read books and explore galaxies and seeing all these different worlds and all these different cultures. My goal at first was, I kind of want to go to medical school. And then it was, I don't want to go to medical school because I'm really bad at math. So that's how that kind of went about. And I'm just like, okay, well, I think I'm decent at writing poetry and putting like things together. Looking at it now, the library prepared me for poetry being my outlet.
This is Luis Carranza. He's a teen poet and a member of Louder Than a Bomb, the largest youth poetry festival in the world. And earlier, I was talking not entirely facetiously about this generation having superpowers. I mean, they organized a national high school walkout. Thousands of kids in cities and towns all over the country took part. How did an entire generation suddenly find its voice? Well, the truth is that it wasn't all that sudden. Young people have been speaking out. For example, every year, thousands of teens from all over Chicago compete in a citywide poetry slam, Louder Than a Bomb. Charles Monroe Kane sat down to talk with its founder, poet Kevin Koval, and with two young poets, Luis and Key Stein.
You guys are ready for a poem, aren't you?
Yeah.
For sure.
Superheroes in the building.
Superheroes in the house. Oh, there's another name for... Oh, God, you guys. I hope you're writing this stuff down. Kevin, let's start with you, man. Like,
you know, I've been, like most Americans, I've been transfixed by these teens and...
It seems like there's a bit of a revolution. I don't want to overuse that word, but there's a bit of a revolution afoot. What role do you think poetry has in such a revolution?
Well, I think poetry, in part, can encourage our radical imagination to be unfurled in the civic sphere. This moment has certainly been imagined, and it's been imagined by people who I think are dim-witted and have limited imaginations. And I think part of what the poetic imagination does is, you know, kind of everything is maybe up for grabs. Everything can be also seen and reimagined. And so I think part of what you hear from young people at Lalla the Nabam, part of what you're hearing from young people in Florida, is that they are insisting that they also have a say in the narration of their lives and also a say in the way that we move forward as a citizenry.
Keith Stein, let's start with you. You're one of the poets that Kevin works with. Do you feel like you have any superpowers?
I feel like our work is revolutionary. I can't really think of another word. I just feel like it is revolutionary. The ideas and just the messages that we're trying to get across need to be heard. Yeah, I think we're just one step closer.
Do you have a poem for us that you wrote?
For sure. So this is some new stuff that I had written a couple weeks ago, actually. I kind of explore the worlds of blackness, womanhood, and queerness. So this poem is titled Queer, A Crawl Space. Austin says he will pay me to kiss Ames on the lips. I tell him, ew, no, partly because I don't mess with male fantasies of lesbianism, mostly because I'm too embarrassed to say, shoot, I would do it for free. The internet calls this an experimental phase, but I've liked Rosario Dawson since I was 8. My old man calls this no child of his will be, insert derogatory term for queer. I don't quite understand what it means yet. I just know it feels like being the punchline to a joke that's not funny. Still, I kiss Sarah back, watch girl-on-girl porn, and open pamphlets from the center on Halsted. My older brother says, yo, this is the kind of gay stuff we're all talking about. Still, I dream about Rosario and watch Ellen Tube, so maybe I do understand queerness. IDK. It looks like the rainbow flag in Vicky's bedroom, and Vicky, the first they that I've met. It's sinful black 002 polish in the Brown Girls web series. It's Gaga night at the tavern. I'm not legal, but Alice the bartender let me in because I'm cute. Maybe queerness is keeping the coming out in. My larynx, a crawl space my crushes can't stand up in. Or the flannel I stole from Discount Outlet. The checkered pocket that held my first female condom. And me, too afraid to use it.
Yo.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh my God. Keep writing.
For sure.
You know,
Bars.
It seems like every generation got Bob Dylan in the 60s. How is this generation, you think, different from other generations?
Well, I mean, that's true. Like, we are also in a lineage. Certainly, there have been many people before us who have done this work. I think the thing that is significant about this generation is that they are also increasingly unafraid. One of the beautiful things I think about working with young people over decades is you see every generation revealing new and new freedoms, pushing us forward as a consciousness more radically inclusive of people that we've intentionally put at the margins of public discourse. And even in Key's poem, you see the rich intersectionality that's occurring there. I think it's because Key and Luis, who's also in the studio, and a lot of the poets that we work with are profound humanists who also demand that we see the identities of the multitude, but we also hold up those identities and not do the work that I think American multiculturalism has gotten wrong and saying, like, oh, see, look, we're all the same. I think part of what the poetic imagination is say, actually, there's all of this difference, and that's the richness.
But Key, at the same time, I hear your poem, and I'm a 50-year-old white dude, straight white dude, right? So it is universal as well, if you start when you get human. Key, you know, I when I hear your poem, the word permission keeps coming in my mind. Like, who gave you permission? Do you feel like you need permission?
I think for a long time, being young and feeling like I didn't have much of a voice or I wasn't given the space to be so vocal, I've just got to a point where, like, I keep finding my voice every day. And so having the confidence and finding that to talk about things that aren't so comfortable for other people, and also just giving myself permission to, like, be comfortable with my truth and to express it whenever I feel.
Now, Luis, how are you today?
Good. And yourself?
I'm excellent.
Perfect.
I want to ask you a question similar to Key's. Do you have a superpower?
Yeah, I think I have the superpower of, like, changing who I am in order to inspire others to do better for themselves and try to see themselves in me. I feel that if I could change myself, ultimately I could change the world.
Do you have a superpower poem for us?
Yes, I do.
Let's hear it, man.
En el norte todo es mejor. So my parents migrated from Mexico to el norte, only to end up in the southwest side of Chicago. They still believe the north side is better than the southwest. Allá todos tienen dinero, my parents both say. Both minimum wage factory workers dreaming of a house of their own. And I know a piece of their heart was lost somewhere in the desert. My concerns are no different. I dream of a good job where it involves poetry and a role model family like the ones in magazines and TV. And if I should forget I am Mexican and be more American like the rest of my friends who don't eat tortillas on Thanksgiving dinner. Or that I'm from Little Village, where I fell in love for the first time. Where I learned to forgive, to hurt like the day my buddy David died. I am 19 years old, which translates to 25 years of my parents not having papeles, which can also be understood as 25 years of unfulfilled dreams. Sometimes I wonder, what's so good about El Norte, other than the sacrifice and courage it takes to live in solitude? On the bright side, my parents learn to let go and sing their happiness, like my mom who sings to my grandma through long-distance phone calls. Mexico lindo y querido, si muero lejos de ti, que digan que estoy dormido. Y que me traigan aquí, si muero lejos de ti. It's the conversation my mom has with grandma, who keeps asking to come home already. My dad, on the other hand, is trapped in a vicious working cycle. He wants to send my siblings and me to college, you know, for a better future or whatnot. My dreams are no different. I dream to grant my parents a stress-free retirement, have a role model family, where my parents get to spend time with my kids, buy a home in Little Village, and being okay with eating tortillas on Thanksgiving dinner. Build a memorial for my buddy David, but most important, I want my parents to be with me y que no mueran lejos de mí. And that's that piece, y'all.
That's that piece.
Thank you, first, for reading that. That's powerfully read and powerfully written. Key and Louise, I have a question for you, and I think it's not just about poetry, about you, but just generally, like, your generation's huge. By numbers, it's huge, and we see these Parkland teens and think about them trying to just change the NRA or change gun laws in America. Like, are you guys going to do it? Are you guys going to change the world?
I hope so, because I don't think many adults are doing it for us.
That's true.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely the goal. I've been watching, like, all of these videos on YouTube, just of, like, the Parkland students. It's completely inspiring, again, like, revolutionary, and we just need people to listen to us.
Fair enough. That's why you write poetry, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You have the mic, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, Luis, what about you? You think your generation's going to change the world?
I think that's the plan, you know?
That's the plan? Okay, good. That's what the plan was.
I think that's the plan, but I also think in terms of, I think I'm going to get old eventually. So it's also about investing time and giving back to the other generations to come. If we don't invest time in the other generations behind us, then we're also fading in a sense, because then when the power gets turned over, how are they going to react to it? It's really about investing time and always, I feel that I stress this a lot. It's always about giving back to the community.
Kevin, you're more observer, I think, than I am on this. Can they do it? Can they change the world?
Well, they're doing it. And part of what they're saying and part of what I hear is that there's also an urgency. And part of what happens, I think, with adults is that we get complacent. We're like, oh, well, this current system has been put in place for, let's say, 2,000 years. So it's going to take that long for it to undress itself. And the reality is that young people are like, no, we can't wait another day because we're losing people right in this moment.
Luis, and all of you, Kevin, Key, how do we hear teenagers better so we can hear the change?
Don't think as young people being tokens. Oh, this is just the young face in the room. And you kind of like not really pay attention to it, then I feel that that's when young people start feeling not valued and not appreciated. Just asking a little question like, how was your day? Even if they're having a bad day, just the fact of you asking and trying to be actively involved to do something.
I think it's a matter of patience and open-mindedness. There's not enough effort being put into hearing kids out. You give students a mic and a stage and a pen, and you're telling them, okay, it's it's okay for you to pour your hearts out. And that's the greatest tool that we have right now.
That's Key Stein, Luis Carranza, and the founder of the Louder Than a Bomb Youth Poetry Festival, Kevin Koval. They were talking with Charles Monroe Kane.
It's morning again in America.
So some teens are activists, some are poets and community organizers, and some are choosing a more traditional route to power.
So I was in my room. It was a later night, around 9 o'clock. To be honest, I probably shouldn't have been doing my AP Physics 2 homework. Sorry, Mr. Meyer. I was trying to think of, you know, is this something I really want to do? I'm going to be busy with my schedule, but I'm up to a challenge.
Like your whole world depended on it.
Went to the Secretary of State's website, filled out a questionnaire asking you for your information. I clicked submit. I'll be honest, didn't talk to my parents before I did it. I went downstairs after I did. I told my dad, hey, I just registered to run for governor. And
I'm asking for your vote.
Said simply, oh, what's new? So I said, no, really? He says, oh, well, good luck.
And I approved this message.
Next day, got a call from a Hutchinson newspaper, and it's kind of where it all began.
Tyler Ruzick was one of six teens who recently ran for governor of Kansas. We talked with him about his campaign before the race. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Well, all right.
We're the nation, and we're on the move. Nothing can stop us now.
We're talking about Generation Z this hour, which is arguably shaping up to be one of the most activist generations in recent memory. And some of them have their eyes on public office. In Kansas, there were recently six teenagers running for governor. Tyler Ruzick was one. And when we caught up with him right before the race, he had a message for his fellow teens.
I think definitely more teenagers need to be running for office. It just feels so amazing to be a spokesperson, I guess a de facto spokesperson kind of for my generation, but it's not just me. There are other teens running. There are other teens doing wonderful things. I think the next 15 to 20 years, we're going to continue to be elected and we're going to get into places of power. And I think the adults are taking us a lot more seriously as a result, because in some instances, we're their formidable political opponents.
You mentioned your generation feels frustrated looking at the way adults have been running the country. What makes you think teens would do any better?
Yeah, so Congress, absolutely. We're really frustrated with how Congress has conducted itself, that they're playing roulette with politics when it comes to the government shutdown. I think both parties felt that, you know what, if they didn't come to a deal, then they could try to spin the government shutdown against the other party and try to use that as a 2018 campaign tactic. Shutting down the government to one-up their opponents is, I think, despicable.
It must strike you as hugely ironic that you're not too young to run for governor, but you are too young to vote. You're too young to vote for yourself.
Well, for now, I'm going to be 18 come the midterm election.
Okay, so you can cast a vote for yourself.
Yes, yes.
Phew.
So if the election were today, I wouldn't be able to.
Do you think we should lower the voting age?
I'm going to be honest with you. I think that 18 is a good age. if you're old enough, you know, at least in some parts of the state or country to buy tobacco or get a full driver's license and some states be 18, I think you're just fine to be old enough to vote. I think 18 is a good age. I do feel at the same time that 16 is a little bit young. Maybe 17 could be a possibility, but it's not a biggest concern of mine to change the voting age.
What are some of your key ideas? What would your first act as governor be?
The state Supreme Court ruled twice in our state that the way we fund public education in Kansas is not in line with the state's constitution. So we need a better, more specific definition. And then once we have that, work with the state legislature to find ways to just increase public school spending, because I have been in the public school system my entire life. It has been such a joy to be a public school student, and I couldn't be prouder of that. Public education needs to be the top of our priority. Not only is it a driver of the state's economy, making sure we have a good, well-educated workforce, but it is how we create leaders.
You know, it's interesting. I'm surprised you're running as a Republican. Your views on education spending sound pretty liberal.
I get that a lot, and we could even discuss guns. I'm pro-gun. I believe the Second Amendment's really important, but I'm against the NRA. I think the NRA has too much power, and I know that can separate me a whole lot from some of the elites in my party, but I don't believe any particular lobbying group, especially that of the NRA, should have as much power as it does. On education spending in particular, I don't feel that that should be a partisan issue, but it has definitely become that. I mean, I'll agree with you on the fact that people feel that they have to pick a party or pick sides on the issue of education. I don't think it should be that. That's not a Democratic issue or Republican issue. That's just an issue of making sure that our society does well.
Can you give the adults listening some advice? How do you think adults could better listen to teenagers? And what can adults learn from you?
If there, I suppose, is one thing that I want them to know and to tell them, is that the youth movement is a movement of unity. It's a movement of working together, cooperation, saying that no matter your race, your age, your religion, your sexuality, your political views, if we focus on where we agree instead of where we disagree, then we can get things done. And to me, that's what the youth movement is. And that's why I think it can appeal. No matter your age, you can belong in the youth movement.
Wow. Sign me up.
Yes.
Does your campaign have a theme song?
There's so many, especially for my personal taste. It ranges from Queen to George Clinton to 90s hip hop. I suppose if there is maybe one, that's a tough question. I would probably say it would be Neil Diamond's America. You know, it's been used in many other political campaigns, but that aspect of the American dream is, to me, is so important. And that no matter where you come from, whether you're a first-generation American, whether you're yourself an immigrant, or your family has been here since the Revolution, you have just as right to everyone else, to the American dream. So I suppose that's maybe a song. I'd have to think a little bit more about it. But a good slogan I've had has been that I'm a Republican for the next generation. That's what I've been campaigning on. I'll give it to you. That's a tough question. I'll think about it.
Okay. Well, sorry to put you on the spot.
No, it's all right.
Just curious. Anyway.
Need the hard-hitting questions, right?
Yeah. Tyler, thanks so much for talking.
Yeah, of course. On the boats and on the planes,
they come into America. Tyler Ruzick. He's 17, a Republican, and though he did not win, he recently ran for governor of Kansas. So part of me thinks, I love this. But, you know, I've raised teenagers. They have trouble remembering where they put their homework. They'll play video games until 3 in the morning, the night before a test. They post recklessly inappropriate things on social media. Okay, to be fair, so does the president. But as neuroscientists keep warning us, the teenage brain is a work in progress. Could that perhaps be a good thing? Steve Paulson asked neuroscientist Frances Jensen to weigh in. She wrote the best-selling book, The Teenage Brain.
How exactly is the teenage brain different from the adult brain?
It's more different than we ever thought. The brain is the last organ in the body to develop, and it is not done until your mid to late 20s. Teenagers are therefore not adults with fewer miles on them, so there's actually more activity going on inside the teenage brain. The teenagers are able to form connections between their brain cells, which is how we learn. They can do that more rapidly than adults, not quite as rapidly as children. You know how children can learn 2 and 3 languages flawlessly?
Right.
Well, teenagers aren't quite that good, but they're much better than adults. They're really learning machines. We call that plasticity, that mm-hmm. you can build your brain to your environment, if you will. So you expose a brain to one thing, and you're going to build a richer set of networks to deal with that thing than something else. So they're still in this golden period, but there is a paradoxical weakness of the teenage brain in that these brain regions that all have specializations, you've got a region for vision, for motor, for sexual function, for emotion, for executive function, all have to be connected to one another. And that process takes a lot longer because the brain is very complex. We have 100 billion brain cells approximately, and they're making 100 trillion connections. And these have to be actually insulated with a natural insulator called myelin that allows these signals to go rapidly from one side of the brain to the other or back and forth or inside brain networks. That process takes a really long time. The wrapping of all of these tracks takes a really long time. And that's the thing that's not over until the mid to late 20s. So their brain is still connecting.
What are the implications of that, that all this connectivity hasn't really set in until our mid-20s or so?
So the brain, interestingly, connects from the back to the front. Turns out the frontal lobe is important for executive function, empathy, impulsivity, judgment, organization, decision-making, and impulse control, right? So we have that very well connected as an adults. Teenagers have that frontal lobe. It's not like they don't have one. That takes until, again, the mid to late 20s. Hence, we see teenagers that do have risky behavior. There can be issues with empathy, judgment. This is kind of what typifies what we think in society when we think of a teenager. But there's neurobiology behind it. There's a reason they're like that. Nature's built them that way.
There might be some positive things about greater impulsivity, more willingness to take risks.
Yes. So teenagers are more prone to risk-taking and novelty-seeking. So that is part of brain development, to go and probe the environment, to be compelled to go and experience. But the downside is that some of those might be unsafe risks.
We hear a lot about the problems, especially the impulsivity, the risk-taking. And I'm wondering if there is really a positive spin to take on this. Have we only been focused on the problems?
Adolescents get a really bad rap, I think. Of course, there's some negatives, but there's also positives, and it's all coming from the same biology. So yes, that novelty seeking and the ability to learn really quickly means that if they want to try a new instrument or if they want to learn a new language, they're going to learn this much faster than an adult would. In fact, you can actually change your IQ still within your teen years, which is a new fact that came out of the science that's only been quite recent.
So make the case for why more risk-taking is actually something that we need. Why we need those teenagers to be out there sort of pushing the limits that we adults might have sort of kowtowed to.
They have a lot of energy. They have a lot of creativity. They have a lot of ability to learn things. But we are the adults around them. And I sometimes say we have our frontal lobes and they're connected. And sometimes we should give them a frontal lobe assist from time to time.
Which means what?
They may want to take a risk, but go just that bit too far.
Well, and I was going to follow up on this whole notion of risk-taking and why that's valuable and sort of looking at it in a different way. And I'm thinking about those student activists in Parkland. Mm-hmm. They have not been beaten down by the world or become as cynical about what is possible as so many adults are. And I think that's why so many of us have been so inspired by them and that they have not gotten the message, for instance, that changing gun policy is hopeless.
Yes. One of the hallmark features of the developing brain is their resiliency. And it comes from this property of plasticity. Part of this is the resiliency that they're going to turn something terrible into something better, into action. It's also important for you to know that there are also areas of the brain that control emotion. Adolescents can, and there's studies that show this, have more strong emotional responses to stimuli than adults do. And we see this in day-to-day life with teenagers. One of the kind of negative things that are said about them, oh, they're just so emotional, they're going off the handle, they're frustrating me. Well, that's biology playing itself out. And you have to wonder whether some of that is part of what you've seen with these student activists, that they are feeling so compelled because they are having a very strong emotional reaction to what happened. It may be propelling them to be even more active than, say, an adult.
Yeah. You've had teenagers yourself, right?
I have.
Did you apply your knowledge as a scientist to your parenting? I mean, I'm wondering how that went over.
It really helped me become a more patient parent. It allowed me not to alienate them. I think we as parents and adults around our teenagers have to provide them with more explicit information because it's not necessarily going to occur to them in the split second. So I think we need to talk about likely risks that will occur in their environment in college or in high school, because their brain is not going to be making those connections at the moment their peers are cajoling them into doing something illegal. That peer pressure is housed in this limbic center, which is very active, and they don't have their frontal lobe being able to say, you know, this may not be a good idea. I could actually get arrested or something like that.
So going back to your own kids when they were teenagers, I'm curious about how you put on your science hat, if you did. I mean, did you say, you know, your brains are still developing. Your frontal lobe isn't fully there. You need to take extra precautions. Did you try to say that?
I really did. I did. And then things would happen. Like one of my kids who was a super good student totaled his car by taking a left turn into an entrance actually to school in the early morning when he should have waited for the other car in the other lane to go by, which of course was driven by a 23-year-old guy. And of course they had a collision. And I looked at him like, why? And he's like, I know. But, you know, but you can't, you know, these things happen on a weekly basis with teenagers. This is biology playing itself out.
So today's teenagers are almost the first generation that's been wired their whole lives. I wonder what kind of a difference that has made. I mean, are their brains actually wired differently than pre-internet generations of teenagers?
Well, there's research currently being done on that. There is research now to suggest that certainly early in life, because of course you have to follow these people for a number of years. And many of the studies that are starting to get published are really about children exposed to the internet, and because they've been able to follow them out a little bit. But some of the research suggesting children that have been exposed to higher levels of screen time before the age of 2 or 18 months, actually they're having difficulty with interpreting social cues and vocabulary maybe.
And yet on the other hand, teenagers are so well networked.
That's right.
They're just constantly in touch with other people. They're on their social media platforms. I mean, there are tremendously positive elements to that as well. I mean, they can mobilize people really fast in a way that probably you and I can't.
Exactly. And again, going back to this movement in Florida, that's got to be part of how they've pulled themselves together. And that is something they're showing us how to do, because adults are not really as good at that way of connecting at this point. There are many positives of what this social media, social connectivity, and barrage of information coming at them. They are, as I said, learning machines. The question is, what is too much? How much is not age appropriate? How much is going to cause stress versus be good for the brain? And it's all happening so fast. It's happening within like half a generation. Millennials have a very different experience than today's teenagers. And that's only like 6 years difference.
Right. Maybe the way we should really think about technology at their fingertips is that's an extension of the brain. In other words, maybe the question we should not be asking is it biology or is it culture? It's both. This is an extension of what they're wired to do in their own minds.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that I've asked millennial people this, and that's exactly what they say. They're like, well, why should I have to memorize that when I can just get it here? I can use my brain for something else. We remap our brain on a dynamic basis. This is happening throughout your brain as you're learning different skill sets. It's constantly sort of redistributing resources, if you will. The sky's the limit. It's going to be very exciting to see what we can achieve. We have to be able to think of it in terms of how we do our education in this window. I told you IQ can change in the teen years. So I think there's a huge opportunities for the educational system, arts, athletics, to think about how do we use this period where the basic building of the brain happens in childhood. And then the adolescence is where we're building the more sophisticated, nuanced parts of your brain function. And there's a great deal of plasticity there.
That's Frances Jensen, chair of the neurology department at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School and author of The Teenage Brain. She was talking with Steve Paulson. We're talking about teen activism today, and coming up, the story of the book that's inspiring young Black girls everywhere to find their voices, The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas.
I first got the idea for the book when I was in college. I went to a mostly white, upper-class, private Christian college in Mississippi while living in a mostly Black poor neighborhood. I had to be two different people in these two very different worlds. But my struggle of being two different people became harder when a young man named Oscar Grant lost his life in Oakland, California. And although that was hundreds of miles away, it led to conversations around me. In my neighborhood, Oscar was one of us. I knew Oscars. I grew up with them. I saw them every single day. But at my school, there were people who said that, well, maybe he deserved it. He was an ex-con. Why are they destroying their own community over some guy who was just going to probably end up dead? And some of these people were my friends, I thought. And they were saying these things, and I didn't know how to correct them or to criticize them or to say no. I figured I had two options. I could either A, burn down my entire campus, or or I could use those emotions in my art.
Coming up, the woman behind the best-selling, award-winning book, soon to be a movie, Angie Thomas and The Hate U Give, next. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas is being called the Black Lives Matter novel. It's one of those books that spread almost virally. Within weeks of coming out, it was the number one YA book in the country. It was nominated for a National Book Award. It's being made into a movie. And The Hate U Give tells the story of 16-year-old Star Carter, who witnesses the shooting of her childhood best friend, Khalil, at the hands of a police officer. Here's how it begins.
When I was 12, my parents had two talks with me. One was the usual birds and bees. Well, I didn't really get the usual version. My mom, Lisa, is a registered nurse, and she told me what went where and what didn't need to go here, there, or any damn where till I'm grown. Back then, I doubted anything was going anywhere anyway. While all the other girls sprouted breasts between 6th and 7th grade, my chest was as flat as my back. The other talk was about what to do if a cop stopped me. Mama fussed and told Daddy I was too young for that. He argued that I wasn't too young to get arrested or shot. "Star, star, you do whatever they tell you to do," he said. "Keep your hands visible.
Don't make any sudden moves. Only speak when they speak to you. I knew it must have been serious. Daddy has the biggest mouth of anybody I know, and if he said to be quiet, I needed to be quiet. I hope somebody had the talk with Khalil.
So you said in the beginning, back when you were in college and mm-hmm. Oscar Grant was killed, that you weren't comfortable mm-hmm. yet having a strong voice about that. And I was wondering if writing the novel you felt was a process for you personally of finding your voice.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I'm definitely more outspoken now than I was before I wrote this book. It changed me in a lot of ways. And in some ways, I've had to become more outspoken because there are people who don't understand why you would write a book about a cop killing someone. Are you anti-police? Then you have the school district in Texas that banned the book simply because of the language.
Because you write it the way people really talk.
Exactly. There are curse words in the book, but I did the count with my Kindle, and there are 93 instances of the F word in the book. But there are 936 police killings this year alone. Which number is bigger? I'm okay with people saying, oh, the language makes me uncomfortable. If the language is what makes you uncomfortable, consider yourself privileged. I'm more uncomfortable about the killing of unarmed Black people in this country.
The book begins with a death. Khalil mm-hmm. and Star, they're out one night, and Khalil is shot and killed by a police officer, mm-hmm. and Khalil is unarmed. What was it like to write that scene? And mm-hmm. I don't know, how much did you think about it, and how much did it just pour out?
That scene was definitely one of the hardest to write. I made myself watch footage from various shootings. Then I made myself stop because I didn't want to overwhelm myself. Mm-hmm. And when you're watching these things over and over again, it becomes traumatic each time more and more. But I wanted to show it from Star's view, keep the lens on her as much as possible, because when Khalil is gone, this is who we're left with. I think of Rachel Gentile, Trayvon Martin's friend, who was on the phone with him when he was confronted by George Zimmerman, and what that must have done to her. So I had to, for a second, put myself in Star's shoes more than anybody's shoes. So how does this one moment affect her life? It's going to change her entire life.
The title's from Tupac, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. The title comes from Tupac's Thug Life tattoo. A lot of people know him for having that tattoo across his abdomen, but they don't know that Thug Life was an acronym for the hate you give little infants F's everybody. And he explained that as meaning that what society feeds into youth has a way of affecting us all. And he said this in 1992 in reference to the Los Angeles riots. A lot of people associate...
Which began with the Rodney King.
Right. Right. Well, that's one thing, but a lot of people don't know. It was a big influence for those riots was the death of a young lady named Latasha Harlan, who was 15 years old and was killed by a store owner there in Los Angeles who accused Latasha of stealing a bottle of juice. Latasha had simply put her money on the counter and was walking away, and the store owner shot her in the back of the head. And it was on video. And the store owner got away with it. And that was another thing that fueled those riots. So Tupac said that the hate that was given into that little infant, Latasha, affected the entire city of Los Angeles. We're talking millions of dollars in damage. So when I was writing the book, I was thinking about what he said, and I still see it now, Thug Life. The hate that was fed into Michael Brown affected the entire city of Ferguson. The hate that was fed into Trayvon Martin affected the entire city of Sanford, Florida. The hate that was fed into Mir Rice affected Cleveland.
You've been a hip-hop artist yourself, right?
Well, I wanted to be a rapper when I was maybe 13 until 16 or 17. For me, it seemed as if rappers were the only people who were telling stories that I actually saw myself in. Books did not. Children's publishing failed me at that age range because I could not connect with Bella Swan in Twilight. You know, I tell people all the time, my mom would not have let me date a guy that old. So I couldn't connect with it. So I saw myself in music. I saw myself in hip hop. But there's only so much you can say in a song. So I have a 400 and something page book. I could not have gotten this into a song.
The book has just rocketed to the top of bestseller lists. It's long listed for the National Book Award. It's going to be a movie.
Yes.
It's been an amazing journey, and congratulations.
Thank you.
But I think probably what's even more rewarding for you is it's just struck such a nerve for so many young people. I know you just get mobbed by young readers when you go places. What do they ask you about?
I have a lot of kids who read it, and after they've read it, they're like, okay, so what do I do now? How do I change systemic racism? I've had girls who've come up to me and said, I'm ready to change the system. I'm ready to turn it over and fix it. This past weekend in Mississippi, actually, the state celebrated the opening of our Civil Rights Museum. And President Trump came to Mississippi to visit the museum. It led to a lot of controversy. And I had three young Black girls who came to my signing. They had on these T-shirts that said Black Girl Magic, Black Lives Matter. And they had their signs with different things for Mr. Trump to see. And they said, we came to your sign and we want you to sign our book, but could you kind of be quick with it because we have to go protest. They said they were inspired by Star to speak up and speak out and make themselves heard. And that did me all the good in the world because I see them being exactly what I wanted Star to be in the book. So they were going to go make themselves heard and make sure our president heard them.
Wow. That makes me want to cry.
I know.
That's so great.
But they give me hope.
Yeah.
Teenagers give me hope. We write them off so often, but I'm seeing a lot of things in this generation that's coming up that gives me a lot of hope for the future. So I tell them, when I'm in the old folks' home, I think I can relax because I think you guys are going to do a great job.
Angie Thomas. The Hate U Give is her debut novel. Thanks to the Book Lovers Resource Reading Group Choices for connecting us with her. That's it for this hour. Check our website at ttbook.org for podcasts and to sign up for our newsletter, where you can catch up on archived shows and see what our producers have been reading and listening to. This week, we asked our teenage guests what music they listen to, and you've been listening to some. We wove bits throughout this hour, and you can see a playlist on our website. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Mark Rickers, and Halima Shah. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. And teenagers, we're listening to you.
Don't be afraid.
I keep finding my voice every day.
We have ideas.
If we focus on where we agree, then we can get things done.
We just need people to listen to us.
Don't be afraid of change. Take chances.
You're my brother, you're my sister.
That's just the way it is.
The way it is, the way it is.
Oh, yeah.
Something will never change.